Welcome to the Marlton Assembly of God Sermon Podcast. Our church is focused on developing fully devoted followers of Jesus Christ. We hope you are blessed by this message.
So we begin a new sermon series for the month of June, and it's all about the family. It's all, we're all in this together. So we're complementing our Sunday morning teaching with Wednesday night. It's wonderful. And to kick us off today is our guest speaker, Dr. Duffy Robbins. Let me just say this in advance. I heard the message, obviously, at 9 o'clock, and you are going to be extremely blessed. You are sitting under one of the best presenters for youth ministry. He serves at Eastern University for 35 years and is a venerative youth minister who's widely respected among the leading voices in youth and family ministry. But his ministry goes beyond that. He is a constant demand as a speaker for teenagers and people who love teenagers, parents, youth workers, etc. His warm conversational style, coupled with a quick sense of humor and unique ability to make scripture come alive, have made him a popular speaker as well as for Bible conferences, etc. You are going to be blessed. This is not just for parents. This is for all of us. It's all about the family. And so to kick us off, we are extremely excited to have Dr. Duffy Robbins. Would you welcome him this morning to Marlton Assemblies of God? Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be here. And great music, great worship. And I got to tell you, too, that it's a real honor to be here because Pastor Mike, I've had a number of his students over the years in Eastern University come through the Master's Commission. Great ministry. I love what they're doing. And then Andy, good seeing you, and so grateful. Andy was telling me before the service that you guys have used a book that I wrote with my wife, Maggie, and the name of the book is Enjoy the Silence. In fact, the title came to me after we'd had a little bit of an argument, but it's a great book, and congratulations to this couple. Where are the engaged couple again? I just thought, you know, what if you hadn't really planned to be engaged, and then the pastor said that, and you went, yeah, that's us. And anyway, fantastic. What a great adventure. It's funny. Whenever you talk about families, you always get kind of two different vibes going on in the room, especially when you talk about, as I often do, teenagers and families. Because you know the deal, right? If when you people talk about teenagers nowadays, it's always in very grim terms, right? You know, furrowed brow. Oh my gosh, what's going to happen with these people? And it's sort of like Mark Twain said, people often think when your child becomes like 13, you should just put them in a barrel, you know, and feed them through a tube, you know, like for the next 5 years or so until they get to be maybe 18, and you just plug up the tube. It's funny because I actually speak to teenagers as much as I speak to people who love teenagers, and you might imagine you get a little bit different vibe when you talk to the teenagers themselves. A lot of times when they think about their parents, you sort of get a different perspective. It's like the little kids who they were coming out of Sunday school one morning, and I guess that morning they had been talking about demons and stuff, and one of these little guys said to his buddy, you know, do you believe all that stuff they said in there about Satan? And his little friend said, no, it's like Santa Claus. It's our dads. And I don't know if that's kind of how you see it or not, but what I want to try to do this morning is to help you launch this series that is going to be happening over the next month here at Marlton, all in the family. What do we do about family? How do we live out this thing called family? And this would be whether you're a mom or a dad or a son or a daughter, or maybe you're a single parent, or maybe you're not yet married, or maybe you are married, but now you're a grandfather or grandma or somebody, uncle. This, all of us in this church, we are all a part of God's family. How do we live this stuff out? And so I'm going to invite you this morning to turn with me to a passage of scripture. Very brief reading from the Gospel of John. If you have a Bible, just open it to John chapter 1, the very first chapter in the Gospel of John, a great passage to launch this series. It sort of begins where, in a sense, all eternity, where all time begins, at least, the Gospel of John chapter 1, where John talks about creation. Verse 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life. And the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. So just to make sure we understand what's being said here, John is pointing us to the God who's the creator of all things. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So this is the Word who is the creator of all creation. This is important because he then makes a statement that is absolutely stunning. He sort of interrupts all of time with another statement a few verses later in verse 14 that I want us to notice this morning. After saying the Word was in the beginning, the Word was with God, the Word was God, then in John 1:14 he says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Most of you probably know this morning that the word that we use to describe this idea, this staggering notion that John introduces, is the word incarnation. Incarnation comes from the Latin word carne, which means meat. That's why if you've ever had chili con carne, that's why it's called chili con carne, because it's chili with meat, right? Unless you have it at school, unless chili without carne. But basically the idea is that God came to this planet with meat on his bones. That the God of all creation didn't just sort of create and then turn away. This is a God who said, let there be light, and then came and drew near to his creation. C.S. Lewis said it would be like a playwright who writes this amazing drama, and then having written the drama, actually steps up on the stage of his own play. The creator becomes a part of what he has created. In another instance, he likened it to an artist who does this amazing masterpiece, beautiful, beautiful created masterpiece, and then having completed the masterpiece, actually steps into the canvas of his own creation. This is God becoming a human being, incarnate. God became flesh. And when you think about families, there's probably no better notion to cling to than this notion of God becoming a human being and drawing near to us. Over and over again in Scripture, when Jesus talks about God, you see two big images coming to bear. One is God is our Father, and the other is the notion that we, all of us, are part of his family. In the New Testament, this is one of the reoccurring themes, that we in the church are a family. So when we talk over the next month about all in the family, it all comes back to this notion, this verse, the Word became flesh, incarnation, incarnation. Now, I'm going to be honest. When I was in high school, I mean, words like incarnation meant nothing to me. I didn't know most of the church lingo. I remember, when I was in church, it's so cool to see all you high school people here, middle school people up front. When I was in church, I would hear these terms and didn't know what they meant. You know, like I remember during the Lord's Prayer, all the adults would stand up and you kind of felt like you should be saying stuff, but you didn't really know what it meant. And so you just make up stuff that sounds like the real, like, our Father who art in New Haven. How do you know my name? And he is going to make up stuff, right? Never did. Like, lead us not to temptation, but deliver us from email. I remember one time I got very excited in church. I said, I went, Honolulu. And my mom went, oh. But maybe for some of you, this word incarnation is that sort of word. It's just one of those kind of church words. I have to say, even my seminary training, I didn't really understand the power of incarnation and the wonder of this term, particularly as it relates to the idea of family. And I don't think I fully really grasp it until several years ago. I taught my older daughter how to operate a motor vehicle. Now, it's not funny. I grew up in North Carolina, and in North Carolina, when you did driver's education classes, I don't know how they do it here in New Jersey, and having driven to New Jersey, I'm wondering if they really do have classes. But I remember that, the way we did it is you see scary movies. Do they still do like collisions? Just one collision after another, just like macabre, brutal, gruesome, collisions, and then okay, kids, happy motoring, and that's sort of the way we did it. And I don't know what they watched in my daughter Erin's driver's education class. I think it was Mad Max Fury Road, but all I know is this: when we got in the car, it was just like phoom, 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 objects flying past us, and then we got out of the driveway, and it was kind of just this nightmare of sharp turns and speed and quick stops, And of course, she gets this from her mother. Now, I need to explain that I had a policy with my girls. You may disagree with this, but I had a policy with my daughters. I said, girls, if you want to learn to drive the family car, you're going to have to learn to drive a stick shift. You're going to have to learn to drive standard transmission. Yes. Yes. Thank you very much. Two policies later, transmissions later, I changed policy, but I did start off with high aspirations, and anyway, the idea was, this way you can always get home to me. Anybody can drive an automatic, but you will always be able to drive and get back to me if you can drive a standard. The problem is, my older daughter Erin, a very bright young woman, was not able to fully grasp the conversation that takes place in a standard transmission automobile between the clutch and the accelerator, that when one speaks, the other needs to listen, and they can't talk at the same time. And we tried several different images and metaphors, none of which seemed to connect. And so consequently, every time we move forward from an intersection, it'd be just a series of just punishing, just lurching blows to the head and upper body. And sometimes she'd look over at me and go, Daddy, how come when I'm driving, you can't control your saliva? And I'd say, sweetheart, Daddy's been whiplashed into oblivion. Now, the other thing too, and I should, this is just to help you appreciate my story. I grew up in a family with all boys, and I thought teaching a teenage male to drive would not be that different from teaching a teenage female to drive. And they'd be roughly the same dynamic, and maybe that's the case. But in our family, this did not turn out to be true. And I learned this very first lesson, very first intersection, very first instruction. I simply said to my daughter, turn here. She goes, and I said, I just said, it's the way you said it. And so... like from that point on, everything is different. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like such a truck. You so need to stop. OMG. We went from LOL to SOL, scream out loud. And the other thing that was kind of interesting, we had a sort of a tradition in our driver's lessons where we would have the lesson, but at the completion of the lesson, we would have our debrief. What have we learned today? Every parent, every teenage driver knows about this debrief. What did we learn today? And we sort of saved a portion of that debrief for just sort of to talk about what was said during the lesson or what happened that was not funny at the time. But now, like with the ignition off, everybody's a little more lighthearted. And so it would be stuff like, Dad, why did you grab the steering wheel? Because, honey, the woman wasn't moving quickly enough to avoid becoming your victim. Or, like my daughter, Katie, my younger daughter, Katie, had the best line. She was, Dad, I saw the tree. I did too, sweetheart. It was leaning against our windshield, wasn't it? I said, remember, the object is not to spot them, but miss them. In fact, we still laugh about this. It's kind of our favorite line of all time. Daddy, are you okay? Yes, sweetheart. Don't worry. It's just a bloody nose. But these driving lessons were difficult, okay? They were hard. There was yelling and crying and pouting, you know, and then she also got emotional. And I remember we get back to the house, and it would always be the same thing. We'd walk in the front door, and my wife would meet us there. And, of course, my daughter would walk right past her, just walk. It goes straight upstairs to her room. And even though it's a one-story house, just like upstairs. That's how you know they're mad. My wife would always look at me, and she'd always say, "Don't forget why you were doing this. Don't forget why you are doing this." And, of course, I'm thinking, because you won't do this. But actually, what she was saying was very profound. She was saying something very, very important. She was reminding me that there are certain truths you cannot communicate from a distance. That if I really want my daughter to understand something about how to operate a motor vehicle, how to make this journey, that it's not going to happen by me yelling instructions from the side of the road, right? I mean, first of all, it's not safe over there. But you're not going to get it like this. You're not going to get it by, you know, reading the operator's manual from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. You're not going to get it by watching scary movies. You're not going to get it by sitting in a classroom. If I really want her to understand these truths, I've got to be in the car with her, right there beside her, on the journey with her, up close, good time, bad time, laughter, tears, because there are some truths that are so big you cannot communicate them from a distance. If I want her to get this stuff, I have to be beside her, with her, in the car right there. And that is something of what we mean by incarnation. You see, God understood there's no way he could possibly communicate to us his love from a distance. He didn't want to leave it, the Word became Word. So he did something stunning. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. When we begin to think this month about family and what it means to experience and share and live out the love of God, let's understand it's not just the Word become Word. It's the Word become flesh. And the momentum of a life of faith is always to draw nearer, always to draw closer. God came near to us. The Word became flesh. But as over these next few months, as we think about what it means to be all in the family, to be all in and to be family, what it means to live out God's love and to see that love fleshed out, I want us to recognize this morning that it's not just about who we love. It's also about how we live. It's the Word became flesh. Stunning about God's love is that God took initiative. God took the initiative. God loved us first. You go, well, what does that mean? What do you mean God took initiative? I want us this morning to do a little experiment to see if we can sort of flesh out this notion of God's initiating love. And I need actually three volunteers to do this. And so I'm going to ask if you two ladies on the end, you'll be two of the volunteers. And then I'm going to ask the gentleman over here in the blue shirt, you'll be the third one. So you guys just come on up here real quick. Just come on up, yep. Slip your shoes on. That's right. Give him a round of applause. That's right. Come on up here. Oh, my gosh. Just like so scary. Come on up. That's okay. Tell me your name.
Haley.
Haley. Good Hi. To see you. I'm Duffy. And?
Ayana.
Ayana. Cool name. I noticed you didn't say Duffy was a cool name. But, you know, that's okay. Nobody ever does. Tell me your name.
Cole.
Cole. All right. Cole. It's funny because when you're named Duffy, I tell people my name, and they look at me the way you look at somebody with a cast, like, what happened to your leg? Here's what I want to do. Haley, it's not funny. I'm sharing some really painful stuff. I love the way you drew your wristwatch on there. That's very, very cool, Ayana. Okay, so let's do this. I'm going to ask you, Haley, to come over here, right here, and I'm going to ask you, Cole, if you'll stand right here. And then, Ayana, you are in a perfect position. This is what I'm going to do. This morning, we are going to have a tug of Cole. We've been talking about taking initiative. I want to do a little experiment this morning. It's very, very simple. What I want you guys to do is the two of you, Haley and Ayana, I would like you each to grab one of Cole's hands, okay? Yep, Cole's going, come on, dude, get the hands. Yeah, that's right, they're going to grab your hand. And what we're going to do, when I say when I say, and be careful, because the next thing you know, next week, the pastor's going to go, are you guys engaged now? What I want to do is when I say go, Haley and I, you guys are going to pull coal in opposite directions, okay? Let me just explain. A lot of times, because I speak a lot, I know by this point in the message, people tend to get a little bit distracted. And so I've found dismemberment brings them back. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to have you guys pull as hard as you can in opposite directions, okay? So, and Ayanna, I do not want you to show any mercy or grace. I feel somehow this will be okay with you. And I want you to, Haley, to pull as hard as you can, okay? In that direction. Don't apologize. He deserves this. Hey, you pull as hard as you can that way. And let's do this to make it a little bit more a group effort. Why don't we say, everybody on this side of the room, you will all cheer for Haley, okay? And then everybody on this side of the room, you will all cheer for Ayanna, and nobody cheers for Cole. Okay. All right. So are we ready? Excuse me? Oh, yes, you can use two hands, Haley. Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, why don't we move down that way just a little bit, okay? Because if one of his arms comes off, I don't want Ayanna to go that direction. Move down just a little bit like that, okay? I don't know what's going to happen with this thing. By the way, be praying because our lawyers are still talking about the last time I did this. Got some legal issues to resolve. Okay, are you ready? Are you ready? Cole, you look relaxed. Okay, all right. Ayanna, that grip is not going to be adequate. I can tell you that right now. I want both hands on his arm. I mean, look at Haley. She's like totally into it. Okay. All right. Are you ready? On your mark, get set, pull. Pull hard. Whoa. Wow. 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 Yeah. Yeah. All right. Stop right there. That's good. Thank you. Let's give them all a round of applause. Thank you. You can have a seat. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Haley. Good job. Wow. Cole's thinking, yep, another day, women fighting over my body. Excellent. No, you know what's funny about that? It was interesting because first of all, Cole, you and I have never met before. Is that correct? I mean, you were an usher in our wedding. No. But no, we have never met before. And so I didn't, like, set this up with you or anything. And I don't think I realized how, frankly, brutal Haley would be. But here's the thing: is that in doing this, I didn't give you any instruction. But you must have intuitively sort of sensed to yourself when I gave these ladies instruction. I said, I want you to pull coal in opposite directions. You imagined, you thought to yourself, hey, that could hurt. And so you did something that I didn't ask you to do. You decided to pull them towards you. Like you without any word of instruction, you took initiative. You took initiative. You basically said, I have a choice. I can stand here and just kind of let my arms flail and go in opposite directions. That will ruin my golf game, and it'll make it hard to play baseball. And so you basically said, no, I'm going to pull them towards me. What is stunning about John chapter 1 is that God is a God who takes initiative. In other words, you and I, every one of us in this room, we all know this. I'm not telling you something you don't know. All of us live in a culture where our families are being literally ripped apart. Through busyness, through work, through alcohol, through disobedience, through rebellion, through marriage problems, through kids who don't want to obey parents. I mean, through all kinds of issues that want to pull our families apart. Every one of us in this room has a choice to make. We can sort of stand here and sort of let this happen, let this family be ripped apart, or we can do what God did. We can take initiative. We can make the first move and say, I am going to take control of the one person in the equation over whose behavior I have some control, and that's me. And I'm not saying they're right. I'm not saying they're right. But here's what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull them towards me. You go, okay, I understand the concept of initiative. Well, what does this look like in real terms? What does this look like in everyday life? And I'm going to give you two very practical suggestions. But what it means to take initiative, what it means to make that first move, is that we are not waiting for the other person to respond first. You know, sometimes in family, you know, problems, they'll go, well, if they would go halfway, I would go halfway. Look at the Gospel of John. This is not a God who went halfway. This is a God who came the whole way. We don't have to go up to bring him down. We can't go up to bring him down. God came to us. God so loved the world that he came. He drew near to us. What does that look like in everyday life? First suggestion is just in terms of reconciliation, asking forgiveness, making peace. Let me give you a little scenario. It's Friday night, and, you know, teenage son gets home an hour late. Dad, mom sitting in the den, frustrated, angry, pretty much ready to rip his lips off. And so he walks in, and where have you been? Nowhere. What were you doing? Nothing. Who are you with? Nobody. Whatever. You're always spying on me. Just conflict, right? What does it mean to take initiative in that situation? Here's what it might look like. Son comes in late at night, an hour late. Mom, dad sitting there. All of a sudden, the growling starts back and forth. What were you doing? Nothing. Who are you with? Nobody. Where were you at? And then all of a sudden, this party, the son decides to take initiative and says, Dad, I gotta say something. First of all, I realize that the reason you get mad at me when I come in later, the reason you guys are upset is because it's because you love me. And and I just want you to know, I appreciate that, and I know that's important, and I don't tell you guys enough, but I love you too. Now, basically, that's what initiative looks like. It's not waiting for the other party to respond first. It's saying, I'm going to do this first. I could wait here. I could let our anger, I could let our tensions pull our family. I'm not going to do that. I can't control your behavior. Can't control your behavior. I can control my behavior. I take initiative. That's the nature of this love fleshed out, incarnate in Jesus Christ. God came to us. He came first. I'll give you another example. What about this? What about not just reconciliation, not just making peace or asking forgiveness? What about actually doing work around the house? No, seriously. Now I'm going to be honest with you guys, and I'm speaking just in honest terms. When I was a teenager, I was an expert at avoiding labor. I was an expert at avoiding labor. I had a policy at mealtime, for example, that during a meal, I never got up from the table. Because in my family, if you got up from the table during a meal, people would begin shouting requests, you know, oh, hey, would you bring back the butter, or get the iced tea, wash the car? I mean, you just didn't ever get up from the table, you know? And so this, it may not seem heroic, it may not seem like any grand gesture, but here's what initiative looks like. It's something as simple as this. Let's say it's dinner time, maybe today, maybe tomorrow night. You simply don't mention the sermon, don't talk about anything. Remember that guy Cole when he got pulled apart? You know, all you do is say, I'm getting up from the table. May I get anyone anything? I mean, you can just, your dad goes, yeah, you bring your mother some smelling salts. She just passed out, she's drowning in the gravy. I mean, basically, what it means to take initiative is to take the first move. We're not going to wait until somebody asks or somebody deserves. This is the message of incarnation, is that God so loved the world that he came. In fact, Paul writes in the book of Romans, while we were yet sinners, God showed his love for us by sending his son. It's not just who we love, it's how we live. It's how we live. We take the initiative in our families. Let me mention a third idea this morning, and this is important. Because when you think about these words in John chapter 1, verse 14, the word became flesh, it's not just a statement about who we love. It's not just a statement about how we live. It's also a profound statement about how he loves us, how he loves us. Read a book several years ago by a writer named Richard Seltzer. The name of the book was called Mortal Lessons. Seltzer wrote this book about his practice as a surgeon in New Haven, Connecticut. This particular chapter that I found the most compelling was a chapter that opens actually in a post-operative hospital room. There was a patient who was just emerging from surgery, and she was now in an intensive care situation, recuperating and waiting for her to come back to full awareness. As the chapter opens, Seltzer describes a dark little room with the only lights of the room coming from a machine that are monitoring the life signs of the patient. You could very vaguely make out two figures that stood there alongside the bed as the woman is emerging from her surgery. If you've ever had, surgery where you've actually gone under, you know that there's sort of that era of time, that moment of time where you are awakening from the anesthetic and you're not yet fully awake, but you're no longer fully asleep. And your first instinct is to kind of scan the room to see if you can find some fixed point to anchor your awareness. You're wondering, you know, kind of where am I and what's happened to me and what's happened to my body. And it's at that moment that Seltzer opens this chapter. And as we watch from our point, our vantage point there, reading the book, Seltzer says that the woman, the first words out of her mouth as she emerges from this post-operative stupor, she asks in a little tiny voice, she says, "May I have a mirror, please?" There's something she sees in the face of this figure on the other side of the bed that troubles her. It's the face of her husband, and what she sees in his face tells her that something is not quite right. And so she asks for a mirror. There was one in her purse on the bed table right next to her, and so they handed it to her, and feebly she props it up on her chest and looks into it. And that's when she sees the face of a stranger. It's a woman she doesn't recognize. That's when she begins to realize where the problem is. It's at that point Dr. Seltzer explains that he had removed a cancerous tumor in this woman's cheek. And in doing so, he had to slice a tiny twig of a facial nerve. It was a successful operation, but it caused the entire left side of her face just to completely collapse. He said it left her looking palsied. He said, "I left her with this wry, clownish smile on her face carved by my surgical knife." And you could see it as she looked into the image in the mirror. She thought to herself, this is not the face that he fell in love with. This is not the face that he looked into when he asked me to marry him. And there was this long silence as she looked. And then the next words she spoke were these. She said, "My face. Is it always going to look like this?" And Dr. Seltzer said, "I tried to sort of explain to her about the procedure and the necessity of making this cut where I made it, that we did this to save her life and how important it was and how valuable her life was." And they even began to talk about the possibility of some sort of cosmetic surgery, some sort of cosmetic corrective surgery. But he said, I found my voice trailing off in the darkness because neither one of us found my words very convincing. And then he said it felt like that room just got darker and darker and darker until it felt like it was just going to swallow us up. And the only sound in the room was the sound of this soft, pathetic, mournful crying of this woman. And then Seltzer said it was like a flash of light entered the room. Like this bolt of light into the room. All of a sudden, the husband spoke up. He said, "I like it. It's kind of cute." And then Seltzer said, "I watched this guy. I knew that it was unprofessional to stare. I watched with reverence. I understand these are the most intimate of moments between a husband and a wife. But I watched this guy in wonder as he bent down to kiss his wife. And then in the last moment, just before his lips met her lips, he bent and twisted his own face to show her that no matter what, their kiss still worked. You want to know the wonder of incarnation? It is a God who so loved the world that he sent his son. Even in our brokenness, even all of us with our problems and our sins and our stuff, that he came and sent his son Jesus to take upon us all of the temptation, all of humanity, and bent and twisted himself to show us that no matter how bad it gets, no matter how broken we are, no matter how seriously marred and dismembered we might look, the image of God in us so distorted, the kiss still works. In 1 John chapter 4, John writes, "We love because he first loved us." What that means, men and women, for you and me this morning, is that in our families, we are living with broken people. In our relationships, we are living with broken people. In our congregational family, we are broken people. But all of us, seriously disfigured, distorted by sin, are still embraced by a God who looks beyond all that and says, kiss still works. You and I cannot live out this kind of incarnate love unless we are indwelled by that kind of incarnate love. That means we have to know that sort of love. We have to love because we know he first loved us. I don't know your story this morning. I don't know your family. It might be a really difficult situation. It might have been through some really hard stuff. Every family I know faces trials, but here's what I know. No matter how bent and twisted and ugly it looks, the kiss still works. And what's going to happen over the next few weeks is that as you think about families and being all in and being family, is that this message of God drawing close, bringing us near, is a message that can still redeem and remake and make beautiful any family. This is the promise. This is the adventure that we know in sharing God's love. You're going to have a great month. I look forward to seeing how God uses that in your life. Thank you, Aaliyah, for letting me be with you guys this morning. Thank you.